Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I am grateful. My guest today is Lisa Lawson, the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, established in 1948 by the founder of UPS to address the needs of kids around the country. Since 1994, the foundation's headquarters have been in Baltimore, and Lisa Lawson was appointed to lead the organization in 2019. In her new book, Lawson sounds a clarion call to reframe how we see and how we help Generation Z, young people struggling to meet the challenges in their teenage years. Drawing on brain science and her own experience in philanthropy, Lawson offers prescriptions for the kind of support that families, government, business, and nonprofits can offer to help kids prosper. The book is called Thrive: How the Science of the Adolescent Brain Helps Us Imagine a Better Future for All Children. And Lisa Lawson joins me here in Studio A. It's good to see you.
You too, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the scope and the work of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. We'll begin there, and then we'll talk about your book.
Well, the foundation is a national philanthropy that works to create a brighter future for all children. We work to help kids have three key things that we know they need. First, they need strong families. So we do work to improve child welfare and juvenile justice agencies, which often separate children from their birth families. Second, we want to make sure that the families kids are growing up in are economically stable. So we help them get on the path to good jobs, learn how to save and manage money, reduce debt, and also to help those young people get on that path to financial self-sufficiency. And then finally, we want to make sure kids are growing up in healthy, safe places. So we do work to reduce violence in communities, ensure there's affordable housing, and that schools and safe places exist in their communities. So with all of this work, we get to work with nonprofit partners all over the country, more than 900 of them, often with local and state government agencies, and with residents and families and young people themselves. So it's a great way to get a lens into how kids are doing across the country.
So we've had folks from the Annie E. Casey Foundation on the show many times to talk about your Kids Count publication, which comes out every year, talking about the data around children around the country. And I've always known that it's a very important national foundation, but I never knew who Annie E. Casey was until I read your book. And she is the mother of the founder of UPS.
Yes.
And that's how this foundation came into being. So tell us a little bit about the founder and his mom.
Jim Casey has an amazing story. He was born in the Pacific Northwest, grew up in Seattle. His father died when he was 11 years old, and he needed to drop out of school in order to help care for his mom and younger siblings, which he did. The only job he could get was as a messenger delivery boy. He learned all he could about the business, and when he was 19 years old, a family friend loaned him $100 that he used to start his own bicycle messenger company. Well, that little bike company eventually got planes and trucks and became the world's largest logistics company. But he never forgot what it was like to be a young man struggling and seeing his mom struggle, and decided to use his wealth to start a foundation named in her honor to help young people very much like him.
Now, you're the chief cook and bottle washer of the Casey Foundation. Now, you were with UPS for 14 years in senior management, but you also drove a UPS truck. And you talk about that experience in the book. I mean, what did that experience mean for you? Tell us a little bit about that.
It was amazing. Not my finest hour, quite honestly. I only drove for about 3 months and they sent me back to my corporate job. But it was when I was working in Washington, D.C. I was in the government relations department, and the guy who led the department said, everyone who represents us on the Hill ought to have the experience of being a driver. That's what everyone knows us for. So during Christmas, I went out and delivered packages, and it was so much more difficult than I ever thought it would be, but I learned so much about local communities and about how the company served small business owners and really the teamwork that it takes to deliver all those packages all over the world every day.
Yeah, and of course, I've always thought that the closer people are to what's going on the ground, the better decisions they're going to make. One of my silly ideas that I've been talking about for 20 years is everybody in the state legislature should show up on the first day of the session and throw their keys into a box and keep their car keys there for a week, and they should take the bus to work. And if they did that, we would have a transportation policy that was vastly different than what we have.
Very true. You have to experience the challenges that people have. It's one of the reasons why we often say you ought to work with those closest to the problem to help solve them, because they do have a perspective on how the bus system works. I think one of the best pieces of journalism recently was a report that YPR and the Banner did together, talking about children and the transportation challenges they have getting to school every day. It was very eye-opening, I think, for people to understand why kids might be late or not show up to work, because it was so hard for them to get to school every day. So I agree with you. The more we partner with those who are experiencing issues, I think the better solutions will
have. Yeah, it's a great series of articles by Liz Bowie and some others at the Baltimore Banner, you know, because some of these kids are going to schools that take them 3 hours to get to, you know? I mean, it's like driving to New York every day for work. And when it comes to, you know, staying close to who you're talking about, you talk to a lot of kids in this book. You get data from the scientists and from the social scientists, et cetera, but you also talk with a lot of young people. Let's begin by defining what adolescence is. This is another revelation for me in this book. It's a pretty long period.
It is. It's the longest of any animal in the world. It is the period between roughly 14 to 24. And I described in the book as the bridge between childhood and adulthood. And it's a time when young people are learning all kinds of skills related to cognitive development, how to manage their emotions, and how to build stronger relationships with other people. You are correct that very often people mistake puberty with adolescence. Puberty is a much shorter time period. It is a biological process that enables us to reproduce, but adolescence lasts much longer than puberty. And many parents, I think, are surprised to realize that it does last until your mid-20s. But we need to understand that, to understand the range of development that young people are going through.
And there's lots of development going on brain-wise. There's also a lot of development going on between the birth and like 3 years old. And we've, I think, had a lot of people weighing in on that and writing about that. But perhaps we don't pay quite as close attention to the amount of brain development that happens in these adolescent years all the way up through your mid-20s. And that you talk about how research has shown that kids who feel threatened during that period, during that adolescent period, maybe it's because of poverty, maybe it's because of housing security, maybe it's because of violence, whatever the threats are, that affects the prefrontal cortex and the actual development of the brain. So that clearly is going to inform public policy, isn't it?
It should. And that's why I wrote the book, why CASE as an organization spends a lot of time trying to understand this science and apply it in practical ways in how we serve young people. It is a second window of opportunity. There's a lot that happens in brain development in those early years, and we think that's important to get right. But we can't assume children are done by the time they're five. There's continued brain development that happens. And you correctly noted that if young people are going through this spurt of development in extreme adversity, that development isn't going to happen in the ways that we need it to happen or to be finished by the time it would normally happen. So I wrote the book really to help people understand, whether you're a policymaker or a parent, what is happening in the lives of young people. And unfortunately, we don't even tell young people themselves. I tell a funny story in the book that my daughter had a forward-thinking ninth grade biology teacher who explained brain science to her. And the last part of your brain to develop is the prefrontal cortex. And so anytime she didn't do something she was supposed to do, she would joke and say, but my prefrontal cortex isn't developed yet. So I guess I say knowledge is power. But
That may be true, but clean your room anyway.
But as much as we tell young people and warn them about poverty, about puberty, we ought to be doing as much to explain to them what's going on in their brains.
Lisa Lawson is my guest. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Her new book is called Thrive, How the Science of the Adolescent Brain Helps Us Imagine a Better Future for All Children. The other point you make in the book, and I think it's one that people would readily agree with, is that the Gen Z kids you're talking about, this 14 to 24 cohort, it's very different and very much more difficult, I think, to be a teenager and a young adult now than it was in previous generations. And that's not said from the point of view of, back in my day, you know, we used to walk to school in the snow, uphill both ways. You know, it's said because there are so many other factors that are swirling around young people today that simply weren't swirling around them even 10 years ago.
Very true. We've got a generation that is facing rapid technology changes in the form of social media and AI. They are experiencing huge changes in their mental well-being, an epidemic of loneliness and depression and anxiety in young people, a job market that is changing dramatically. These young people have survived a pandemic as children and think about the ways that interrupted their schooling. So I describe adolescence as a bridge, but to your point, the bridge these young people are crossing is very different than the bridge that you or I crossed. And they've got to be agile and prepared for continued changes during their lifetimes in ways that our economic prospects were perhaps much more stable. The technology around us was much more stable. So I say we need to make sure we build a bridge for this time for young people, and all of us have a role in making sure that happens.
And are you convinced that the loneliness epidemic, for example, which we've talked about, I mean, the former Surgeon General during the Biden administration, Vivek Murthy, wrote a lot about this, still talking about this now that he's out of that office. Are you convinced that that's true, that there's more loneliness, there's more mental health challenges now than there were in the 1980s with kids or the 1990s? Or is it just that it's reported more?
No, I think it really is a true epidemic. You know, the antidote to many of these challenges is connection. And I think as more of our lives has gone online, young people have fewer opportunities to connect with one another in unstructured free play ways. It was playing outside in the street that enabled us to make friends and learn how to negotiate social situations. Our young people today have such structured lives in their free time, and so much of their interactions are online that they miss out on a lot of that opportunity to build real world connections, and not just with each other, but with adults who can be mentors and guides in their lives. So I do think they have a very different emotional landscape to navigate than we did.
And you talk about building a bridge between adolescence and adulthood, and you talk about an experience you had literally on a bridge. I think it's called Akura, is that it?
The Aruka.
Aruka, okay. Thank you. So tell us about getting across that bridge yourself with your own two feet and how that serves as a metaphor for so much of what you write about in the book.
Right. I talk about on holiday, I walked across this bridge. It's the longest suspension bridge in the world. It was terrifying to look at, and it's only about 4 feet wide. But I talk about the fact that going across that bridge, I had a guide. I had other people who were with me. They knew how to get across this bridge. I had the right gear. I had good weather. And so my crossing, though it was challenging and scary, was pretty much assured. I had all the ingredients to make that crossing. But I do talk about how young people, so many of them, there are 48 million adolescents in this country, so many of them are crossing this bridge of adolescence without all the things that they need. It might be that they are lacking basic needs like food or housing or, clothing, the proper equipment to cross, or they're lacking a guide, a caring adult in their lives, or they are crossing in great adversity. There might be violence in their community. And so while I was crossing in clear weather, they're crossing in stormy weather. So I think it's important for us to try to make sure all young people who are going to cross this bridge have the right tools, the right guides, and the right environment to make it successfully across. We need all 48 million of those young people to make it to adulthood successfully.
And you have an initiative at the Casey Foundation, which has a nice branded name called Thrive by 25. And again, we're talking about adolescence, which lasts until age 24. So to have kids thrive as they get into adulthood, you say there's five things: basic needs, permanent caring connections, like the ones you're talking about the folks who help you get across the Arauca Bridge, education and credentials, which is interesting to me. It's not just education, it's credentials. So that could be work, there could be other things.
Right.
Financial stability, and then leadership opportunities. I don't think people would necessarily pick all those five things if they were asked to say, what do kids need to do well? Basic needs, everybody understands. But these caring connections, I mean, they can be parents, but they have to be more than just parents. I think all of us, even those of us who are blessed to have, you know, loving, caring, involved parents, still looked
Needs.
Elsewhere and had mentors and important adults in our lives outside of the family. And those connections are harder and harder, it seems, to put together these days. Why is that, and what's the remedy?
Well, it relates to the ways we build those relationships. They often happen in the course of extracurricular activities, or you meet them at your house of faith, or you meet them in your neighborhood. People don't hang out with their neighbors as much anymore. I know they do in your neighborhood, Tom, but they don't always hang out as much anymore. Or people are disconnected from faith institutions, or young people might play a sport in school but aren't connected to other community organizations. But having those caring adults who can help you think about where your first job might be and introduce you to someone who can be a listening ear if you don't feel like your parents are listening to you at that time. They could help you think about decisions that you're making in your life. Having those caring adults around you is essential. And people often think young folks aren't listening to us. They absolutely are. I've heard many of them say, why would I just ask my friend how to navigate this situation? I want someone who's successfully made it through. So they really do value that. And we've got great institutions here in Baltimore like THRED, a nonprofit that works with young people when they are starting high school who might be struggling, and surrounds them with caring adults who stick with them for 10 years and make sure that they get all their basic needs met, are connected to any services and supports they need, and it gets amazing outcomes. So, yes, families are critical. Other mentors and guides are essential.
Yeah, absolutely. And THRED's a great example, and you write about that in the book. Sarah Heminger, who's started it years ago. But it's not just one or two adults. It's a swarm of adults who really, get involved in young people's lives and help. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more with Lisa Lawson. The new book is called Thrive, How the Science of the Adolescent Brain Helps Us Imagine a Better Future for All Children. We will have more on the other side of a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, we continue our exploration of charter school funding with Allison Perkins-Cohen. She's the chief of staff to Baltimore City Schools CEO, Dr. Sonia Santelices. Plus, Congressman Quaisi Mfume will share his perspective on the record-setting shutdown of the federal government. So they'll join me tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Lisa Lawson. She's the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the author of a new book, Thrive, How the Science of the Adolescent Brain Helps Us Imagine a Better Future for All Children. Lisa and I will talk about the book at the Enoch Pratt Central Library tomorrow night. She joins me here in Studio A today, and you are welcome to join us as well. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. So one of the points you make early in the book, Lisa, is that the brain changes that are affected by trauma, that are affected by any number of things. When a brain has been affected by trauma, it develops much differently than when it's not. 18 million people, more than 5% of our country, live in poverty, right? That can mean somehow as much as you report 16.5 million children growing up in families that cannot meet these basic needs we talked about. How are we defining poverty the right way? You talk about ALICE, for example, which you know, something that the United Way has been very involved in, which is an acronym for measuring poverty. I mean, the federal poverty rate, the federal poverty level, just seems so unrealistically low. I mean, how should we be measuring it? Because if we're going to try to solve a problem that we haven't clearly and accurately defined, we won't ever solve it.
Right. There are a number of good measures that one could use. As you mentioned, there's certainly the federal poverty measure, which is based on a food budget from 30 or 40 years ago, which is by all accounts inadequate to really describe the hardship financially that many families face. The United Way has developed a measure for ALICE. You mentioned that's asset limited, income constrained, and employed. They're really trying to help folks understand who the working poor are, those who can't meet the range of basic needs that they have. And then there's also something called the supplemental poverty measure, which our federal government creates, and it takes into account the numbers of folks who benefit from state and federal supplemental programs like SNAP or housing subsidies, et cetera. The bottom line of all this, Tom, though, is that across our country, there's probably 40% of children who are growing up with some level of financial hardship in their homes. It might not affect them every single day, but at some point during the course of the year, they're going to go without a meal. Their families might be highly mobile because they aren't able to consistently pay rent in their home. They might not have a new winter coat that's going to keep them warm in a place like Baltimore. And we think it's important because the very first one of those five things we think kids need to thrive are basic needs. And so we want to make sure that we're all paying attention to the ways that we make sure that kids get those needs met.
Yeah, and of course, if you don't have some of those basic needs, all the other stuff just sort of, you know, it will end up being a feckless endeavor because you don't have, you know, what you need to really literally survive. Let's go to the phones. Tom is on the line in Mount Vernon. Tom, welcome back. Always good to hear from you.
Good afternoon, sir, and to your guest, Ms. Lisa. I want to talk about stressors. You've mentioned many stressors, poverty, many other things. There's some external stressors I experienced in the 1950s and then the early 1960s, ticketed with the Cuban Missile Crisis, was a threat of nuclear war. Many young people were really, really into that. In other words, they were affected by it, and it affected their culture and how they behaved. And I was just wondering, can your guest, Ms. Lisa, mention any stressors today that would parallel that fear of atomic war in the 1950s that we have now? Thank you.
I think one of the most serious stressors young people have is the threat of violence, that they are worried about living in communities where there is gun violence that might make walking to school dangerous, that might make playing outside dangerous. And that's why it's one of the issues we work on as an organization, because you can't have a healthy community if kids are afraid to go outside. We are supporting a range of strategies that are really grounded in a public health approach to violence prevention, trying to work with community residents to reduce conflict and prevent gun violence before it happens, or provide wraparound services and supports to those who have perpetrated or been victims of crimes so that it doesn't continue, or working with young people who have been involved in gangs. A nonprofit here called ROCA is very effective in changing the way young people think, really using an intervention called cognitive behavioral therapy to help them think differently about the choices in their lives. All of it working in partnership with law enforcement and other public agencies to make sure we just have safer communities. And the data is showing that it's working. I think the mayor said today that gun violence is down 31% in the city this year. And that's on top of double-digit reductions last year. So I do think young people are facing very similar external worries. But I'm really proud of the way that Baltimore and other cities we're working with are really taking this seriously and are having really great improvements in that.
Yeah, and the kinds of stress that emanate from poverty are often not quantified. You don't see them on Excel spreadsheets and graphs, but it's tough. I mean, if you're 8 years old and you go to the refrigerator and open the door and there's nothing inside, that is a huge stressor.
A
kid who's not able to, or if you're 18 years old or, 17 years old, it's really difficult, which makes the Trump administration's reluctance to do what they can to fund SNAP benefits. We're talking about 42 million people, black, white, rural, urban, all over the country, who rely on assistance. And if our society can't give assistance to them, what are we here for? I mean, we've got to help when we can, and Congress allocated the money to do it. Governor Moore had another announcement today about supplemental funds to the $10 million that he identified just the other day. And now I think it's up to $62 million coming from the state to allow full SNAP benefits through the month of November. But then who knows what happens after that? Who knows whether Congress will be able to come together and get the government reopened? But the stress of poverty is something that is often ignored. And when you talk to kids, that's what they're telling you.
It's real in their lives. And it's not that one young person struggles with food insecurity and another one struggles with housing insecurity and another one struggles with gun violence. It's that they're compounding, that very often kids are struggling with all of these issues simultaneously, not able to access health care that they need in order to deal with chronic asthma or some other condition. So the real tragedy is that these are individual young people who are trying to navigate, a mental health issue and food insecurity and unstable housing. And while I think people can talk about wanting young people to be resilient, they can't be heroic and overcome just a multitude of challenges simultaneously. They don't have the bandwidth for that. Eventually, people really get exhausted and aren't able to focus on the things we need them to focus on: doing well in school, building relationships with strong relationships with friends and peers. So I would say at the core of what we most want to do is make sure that fewer young people grow up in the kind of adversity we're talking about.
The book is Thrive: How the Science of the Adolescent Brain Helps Us Imagine a Better Future for All Children. The author is my guest, Lisa Lawson, the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, a national foundation based right here in Baltimore. And you and the Casey Foundation do a lot of work with foster care, which, of course, is closely linked to poverty. And there's data that's saying that putting kids in foster care, removing them from homes, even homes that are pretty chaotic and pretty unstable, there's some data to suggest that even these unstable homes are better than being in a foster care situation. Talk about that.
Well, removing a child from their family is a traumatic intervention. We can't sugarcoat it and suggest that then brings happiness and joy to a child. They've been removed from people that they know and that they care, and very often placed with strangers with whom they have no relationship. So there is absolutely reason to be thoughtful about when we utilize their intervention. I mentioned in the book that very often child welfare is used as an intervention for families who are often struggling with issues of poverty, and that we might be better served, and those families could be better served, if we use some of the resources that we spend on supporting foster families and instead stabilize those kids' family of origin. If they need the lights to be turned on, if they need a stable place to live, if that's what's destabilizing their families, those are issues we can remedy and prevent that significant trauma of having a child removed from their family. We want to make sure kids have family for life. And once they're in foster care, that becomes a risky proposition because we don't know if they'll be adopted or if they'll be able to return to their family of origin. And 20,000 kids a year age out of the foster care system. So we want to be very thoughtful about when we make that serious decision.
Yeah, and like so many other issues, it's a matter of how you're spending the money, how you're allocating. You report that states give between $4,100 and $33,000 per child for foster care, but states that up the amount of money that they're addressing, helping to address poverty, has fewer people placed in foster care. So there is clearly,
A benefit to think about that. And we're working with dozens of states across the country. We have an initiative called Thriving Families, Safer Children, which is really trying to focus more on the prevention side of the child welfare system. And states all over the country are really stepping up and want to figure out how they can change their practice in that regard.
And there are alternative models that you talk about. One has the acronym of SOUL. S-O-U-L, support, opportunity, unity, and legal. So it's, again, this kind of holistic support, this holistic approach. I mean, that's been successful in some places.
It is. The SOUL family framework grew out of an interest in trying to address these 20,000 kids who age out of the foster care system without a permanent family. We asked young people themselves, what would you do to solve this problem? And they said, we've often got people in our lives, a coach, a mentor, who we want to rely on and have a permanent relationship with, but there is no legal way to do that. And so the young people banded together, developed a framework, and actually advocated for it to become law in Kansas. And it's really a way for young people to legalize a chosen family, but then they have the support that they need for a lifetime.
And of course, this whole approach, very, very important in the issue of juvenile justice. There's the lock them up, you know, the minute they screw up camp. And then there's the other camp that says, well, show them some love, show them some compassion. It's an ongoing debate. People hear about, you know, particular incidences on the news. They read about it and they say, well, this kid is a mess. He's a menace to society. Get rid of him. You talk about probation in particular. And you say that this is an important area of reform in juvenile justice because it is the sanction that is used in the majority of juvenile justice cases. So let's limit our conversation for the moment to probation. How do you think it's being used or misused, and what should we be doing instead?
Well, probation as an intervention is largely a list of rules that young people are asked to comply with. If they violate those rules, like you must go to school at a certain time, you must be in at a curfew at a certain time, they might be sent back to court. And they violate those rules too much, they might be incarcerated, though they have created no threat to public safety. We asked some of the jurisdictions that we work with, Tacoma, Washington in particular, how might we make probation work better for young people? Too many young people are violating these rules because their brains actually aren't developed enough to follow consistently all the rules that are placed in front of them. How do we use what brain science tells us? Brain science tells us that young people are motivated by rewards, not by punishment. So Tacoma, Washington came up with a system called opportunity-based probation. And young people, by doing the right thing, get points that they can then redeem for a Starbucks card or an opportunity to go job shadow someone in something they're interested in, or to reduce the number of check-ins that they have with their probation officer. And it is remarkably successful that it has reduced the numbers of young people violating their probation by 60 to 70% in the jurisdictions where it's being used. So this is where we say, let's understand how young people's brains work at this age. Let's design our interventions and policies to align with rather than work against them. And you'd be surprised at the kind of success that you can achieve. So it's a strategy that we are working with about 24 states on at this point.
Because you talk about an approach to juvenile justice that considers kids in the juvenile justice system to be broken and in need of fixing. And it's that approach that says, that begins with saying this kid is broken. Rather than what? What's the alternative to broken? Because, you know, if you're stealing a car, if you're carjacking somebody at gunpoint, plenty of people would say, yes, that is a broken child who has no moral compass.
That these are young people who make mistakes, and though they might have committed the crime, they are not young people without potential. And we think it's important to both focus on making sure communities are safe. We think that's important, both for the young people who live there and the community at large. But we also think it's important to make sure that young people have a productive future. We know that any amount of time young people might spend in detention increases the likelihood that they might commit another crime. We know that the research is clear. Most young people who commit a crime won't do so again. They grow out of this behavior. It's part of their adolescent development. And so for those young people who have committed a crime, we believe in accountability, but we also believe in possibility and want to make sure that when we intervene in young people's lives, we do so in a way that gives them a future and doesn't limit their prospects in the future.
Lisa Lawson's new book is called Thrive, How the Science of the Adolescent Brain Helps Us Imagine a Better Future for All Children. Lisa Lawson is the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. That's a nonprofit based here in Baltimore focused on improving the lives of young people and their families. We will continue our conversation after a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WIPR, your local NPR news station.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about helping kids navigate the vagaries of adolescence. Lisa Lawson reports in her new book that the length of human adolescence, about 10 years, is long and unique among animals in nature. It is throughout this challenging decade that our brains develop to be able to handle the decision-making required of adults. Anyone who's been through adolescence knows that it is a period of tremendous discovery and a lot of stress. And for kids who are dealing with that stress in poverty or without the help and guidance of caring adults, the challenges are exponentially greater. Lisa Lawson is the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. She's written a book that suggests ways in which we can help young people succeed. It's called Thrive, How the Science of the Adolescent Brain Helps Us Imagine a Better Future for All Children. Lisa Lawson and I will be discussing the book tomorrow night at the Enoch Pratt Central Library, and you are welcome to join us today here on Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. So one of the five pillars of your Thrive by 25 initiative is education and credentials. When it comes to education, you report that between October 2021 and 2022, 538,000 young people dropped out of high school. And the labor workforce participation rates for those recent dropouts was 41.9%, much lower than high school graduates or college graduates, which are close to 70%. So clearly there's, you know, a link between at least getting through high school and having a job that you can, you know, live on the wages. Here in Baltimore, our graduation rates, I think, hover in the 70 percentile. Nationally, we're at 87%. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about 10 or 20% of all the young people who aren't getting through high school. How do we fix that?
Well, we have some great strategies underway here in Baltimore that are trying to do that. We support the Reengagement Center here in Baltimore that the school system has implemented to try to help those students who've dropped out find a pathway back into school. We've also supported work that specifically focuses on young people who've been in the juvenile justice system. And so that's really important to make sure that as they reintegrate into society, they've got an opportunity to complete their education. We work with the Baltimore's Promise, another leading nonprofit here in the city that created something called Grads to Careers, trying to help young people in Baltimore who might have graduated from high school but aren't in school or working after they finish. And they have helped over 1,300 young people get, again, credentials or a pathway to a job that's going to help them become self-sufficient long term. I think there's just what we're showing is that it's this partnership between the school systems, between community-based organizations and employers that all together are going to make sure our young people have a pathway forward in their lives. And sometimes that is college, but for others, it might be getting a credential in a skilled trade that is going to provide them with a fantastic opportunity to support themselves and their families.
And employers play a role in the education system. We did a segment a few weeks ago with a wonderful guy named Donald Manikin, who heads an advisory board of businesses that work with the school system to provide apprenticeships. And you talk a lot about in the book about apprenticeships and about how employers need to they need to adjust their way of thinking about hiring young people to reflect what's really going on in the current universe. You talk about they have a one-size-fits-all approach, and that doesn't always work.
It doesn't. We need to create more on-ramps for young people to work. And why wait until they finished high school or college to do that? And high school apprenticeships are a fantastic way to do that. I talk in the book about an organization called the Partnership to Advance Youth Apprenticeships, and they are helping more than 2,400 young people across the country get early work experiences. One of the things we know through brain science is that young people love to learn by doing. They don't just want to sit in the classroom. And here's a chance where they can earn money. These are paid apprenticeships to help them and their family meet their basic needs. They're a source of great career exploration. Young people can figure out what they might want to do before they finish high school. And it connects them to mentors and folks in the workplace who can help them adjust to the working world, to know how to dress, to know how to take criticism or feedback, to know how to ask for opportunities. So we think it is imperative that business is engaged in not just creating those opportunities, but helping educators know what they need to be training young people for in the future.
And you talk about the Partnership to Advance Youth Apprenticeships, and they say here there's four things you need to make a good apprenticeship program. They have to be career oriented. That makes sense. They have to be equitable. We don't want to leave anybody behind, for real. They are portable and adaptable. What does portable mean in the context of an apprenticeship?
Just the sense that you're getting skills that you can use in a wide variety of industries. It might be customer service skills, communication skills. That's what's going to help young people make the most of that, because they might. I've talked to young apprentices. Sometimes they're working in the healthcare setting and that's not what they decide they want to do long term. But maybe they've learned something about working in a hospital at the front desk that they can then take to work in a business services environment.
You talk about how 40% of workers, their core skills in just a couple of years, 2027, those core skills will have to change because the technology is moving much faster than employers can even train their current employees. I mean, AI is certainly a big thing. We're talking about companies like Amazon looking to automate hundreds of thousands of their jobs in warehouses now. It's going to be a challenge. I mean, employers and educators are going to have to work together. Are there good examples where that's happening?
They are. And I think apprenticeships is certainly a great example of that. Here in Baltimore, we're working with the school system to strengthen their career technical education programs. That's where those two sectors intersect. And knowing what people are looking for, if it's the skilled trades in manufacturing or if it's in healthcare and more technology skills, the more educators interact with employers, the better they are able to not just make sure their curriculum is aligned, but that these experiential opportunities they provide young people with is going to prepare them.
You talk a lot about giving kids a voice in the programs that are designed to help them. There's a thing called youth grant makers in which kids age 17 to 24 meet, discuss, and award grants to organizations, much like you all do at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. That sounds all well and good, all right? Let the 17-year-olds dispense the money. But on the other hand, they're 17. You've already told me that their brain development hasn't by any means fully happened. So how do you find that balance?
It's a learning laboratory. You have adults who guide young people in these engagement opportunities, but this is how young people learn. It's experiential learning. I've gotten to know many of the youth grant makers who work with Baltimore's Promise on the initiative that you talked about. They learn how to look at data. How do we look at data to understand what programs we might need to focus on in our community? They learn to read proposals and to be critical thinkers in evaluating what they might see. They learn how to budget, how to make financial decisions. We only have so much money. How should we prioritize these various proposals that we've received? It's essential to engage young people. And I think not thinking of it as them doing things all by themselves, but that it's yet another opportunity for them to learn how to think about things. And they absolutely love it. And they have insights that are really valuable in their, if they're determining where money might go for summer programming, they'll know young people are actually more interested in, you know, learning more about video game coding than they might be in learning about something else. And so they can help make sure that these are programs young people are going to use and that they're interested in.
Yeah, they're an asset.
And
we have to think of them as an asset who can be informative to those of us who want to, you know, make a difference.
All right.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it. Lisa Lawson, the new book is called Thrive, How the Science of Adolescent Brain Helps Us Imagine a Better Future for All Children. Lisa and I will be talking about the book tomorrow night at the Enoch Pratt Central Library. That event takes place in the Wheeler Auditorium at 7 o'clock. It'll also be streamed on the Pratt's Facebook and YouTube pages. So, Lisa, I look forward to seeing you then.
You too. Thanks for having me, Tom.
And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Congressman Kwesi Mfume joins me to talk about a possible end to the government shutdown. And Allison Perkins-Cohen, the chief of staff of the Baltimore City Schools, talks about how charter schools fit into the tapestry of educational options for city students. Fresh Air is up next after news. Carol Lenig and Aaron Davis are going to talk about their new book, Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.